So once we zeroed down that we're going to build something for e-rickshaws, the next task was let's just go and talk to as many rickshaw drivers as possible and in different areas, right? Just so that we're not getting a biased view from a cohort of drivers. So we traveled to say, we would go from Gurgaon to Noida in the morning, take like 10 to 20 rides in a day just so that we get to talk to these drivers and figure that out. We would ask them, where do you live? Can you take us there? Where do you charge? Can you take us there? We would then talk to the guy where he was paying to charge his vehicle, how is their business, what are the challenges they see in their business, and so on. Then once we learned that they're using certain kind of batteries, we went back to the battery manufacturers, posing as a buyer and trying to figure out what are the kind of improvements they've seen in that product, what are their expectations on lithium-ion coming and replacing these. Then we would go to the rickshaw manufacturers again, posing as a customer. We did a lot of those things, but there were also some swapping pilots happening at that time.
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jivraj, and today I have me, the founder of one of India's leading EV companies. Join me in welcoming Pulkit Khurana, the co-founder of the BatterySmart. Thank you so much, Pulkit, for joining me. Very delighted to be hosting you today.
Thanks, Jivraj. I was looking forward to it. I think we'll enjoy this discussion.
Absolutely. I'm already running with energy because of the last 15, 20 minutes that we've spoken off the record about a lot of things. I think it'll be interesting. In the next couple of minutes, I want to cover how you've gone ahead and built BatterySmart, the unique solution it offers, how it's a very execution-first business, and how you've exponentially grown in the last 24, 25 odd months, right? But to get us started, we'd of course love to know what got you interested in starting up to begin with, right? You graduated IIT Kanpur in 2012, if I'm not wrong. You built a company before this. You worked at Shuttle, and you've seen some amount of mobility there. Talk to us about life before BatterySmart. What was it like? What were early influences that drove you to the founder life?
Sure. So I graduated in 2012, primarily worked in consulting for the first 3 years of my career. Mostly US-based clients solving their supply chain procurement-related problems, Fortune 500 companies, but on a B1, so shuttling back and forth between India and US. I think my inspiration was my co-founder. So Siddharth, who is my co-founder, is also my batchmate from IIT Kanpur. He was the first one to convince me to get into startups. In 2015, early, we met, and we really hit it off again, and we were meeting after 3 years after college. And he was really bitten by entrepreneurial bug right from college. And that is when we first started brainstorming on what we can do. And we really trusted each other. So I quit my job. He had already quit. And we started deliberating on what we should do. And this was when we stumbled upon a company called Chariot in San Francisco, who was solving for the intra-city commute using buses, right? And that is something we thought that India can definitely use for, given the congestion and pollution problem, and we can build it, right? And we had a couple of guys from IIT Kanpur, started building it out of our house, bootstrapped it, and we were young and naive, and we really didn't have a lot of experience at that point of time, to be honest, but we really wanted to do it. And we bootstrapped it for around 10 months. This is also the same time that Shuttle launched exactly the same proposition, backed by Sequoia. Lightspeed raised like crazy amounts of money. And this is when we thought we might not be able to really compete, and maybe we need more skills to do this. This is when I reached out to Amit, who was the founder at Shuttle. Met him next day, joined the day after. I had no clue about my salary, what my role is going to be. I just wanted to see that space pan out, right? And the idea was I'll do it for a few months. We'll figure out some other idea. In the interim, I wanted Siddharth to not join. I'm going to pay the home bills. And he was doing that before I joined Shuttle. And we were really at the bottom of like finances at that point of time. We've really seen our lows. This is when I joined Shuttle. We still were flatmates for almost all the decade, Siddharth and myself. Kept thinking around what's next, what can we do. Shuttle gave me some exposure to the EV side of things. Buses, launched the first two private EV buses at Delhi Airport, bid some of the EV bus tenders, And Siddharth was also working with UP government, couple of other government bodies on consultative projects around EV policies, right? Okay. And we were obviously living together, always thinking, hey, this space is booming. Should we do that? 2019, we found our confidence back. We thought this is the right time to do it. Both of us quit our jobs. And November 19 is when we registered this company.
Brilliant. I think that's wonderful to hear and brings everything to a great sort of very interesting intersection. Talk to us about this EV space, right? I mean, while we understand that clean tech, EVs is the need of the hour because of the worldwide problem, India's always been, you know, but slow to grasp it. And everybody says it's an infrastructure problem. And there are a lot of things that need to come together for any solution to meaningfully scale. What was it like when you were brainstorming around it? What was the insight like? How did you envision what the future would look like? What was the landscape like? If you can maybe give us insights there, I think that'll clarify a lot of the early, like, 0 to 1 for Battery Smart.
Sure. So a lot of sectors definitely try to find examples from, say, West or China, right? Yeah. India is definitely very different. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're building something for the masses, it has to have a India-based solution, okay. Right? That is what we believe. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this was our second stint, so we wanted to go after a very large market and a large opportunity because your chances of building something big drastically changes if you're going after a larger market. Yeah. We saw that India has a lot of e-rickshaws. Mm-hmm. That's just an Indian solution. E-rickshaws are nowhere else. And they spread like anything between 2015 and 19 when we started. Mm-hmm. There were already like 20 lakh e-rickshaws on the road. Yeah. Some registered, some unregistered, and 700 manufacturers out there doing it. Now, you'll not see that product anywhere else. It's a very jugaad, to be honest, right? And they were running on these lead acid batteries, the ones we used to see in our home inverters, right? Mm. Now, we think that you cannot find a solution for this form factor or vehicle because there is nothing like that anywhere else, all right? We spent like 6 months traveling different cities, talking to these drivers, seeing where they live, what are their problems. Because when we were focused on building something in the EV space right before we registered the company, we knew that we were going to be in this
space.
That
was the space.
Right? Mm-hmm. Within that space, we realized that two-wheelers, there were not many selling in 2019. Mm-hmm. Still, a lot of people had questions whether EV will happen. And like you said, yeah. Infrastructure is not there. How will they charge and so on. Right. But we realized that e-rickshaws are still happening, right? Let's see what are the challenges there. Hmm. It could have been very different. It could have been ride-hailing for all we cared. Yeah, but yeah. We knew that there is some opportunity there.
Correct.
And when we did those discussions with a lot of our customers, mm-hmm. we realized that demand was not really a problem. Also, e-rickshaw is not really a hailing product like cabs. Yeah. So if you look at it from a Uber lens, for example, the problems that Uber solved for, you don't know which cab you can hail. You don't know what price it will ask for. Hmm. You don't know whether it will take you where you want to go, right? Yeah. So you're solving for all those three problems, building it on the app so that you can hail, discover, and know the price, right?
Correct.
E-rickshaw, you don't need to do that mm-hmm. because you know it's going to take 10 rupees. It is a sharing mm-hmm. product and open, so you know whether a seat is available or not. You know it can only go 5 kilometers. And mm-hmm. it is already standing there to be hailed, right?
Correct.
So we realized demand is taken care of, right? Yeah. So what are their challenges? How can they earn more? What else can we do? And we realized these guys just cannot run over 70 kilometers because their batteries do not allow them to.
Yeah.
They need 12 hours to charge their vehicle, right? Mm. Now, if they are facing that problem, is that a problem that every EV faces, mm. right? They were spending like $20,000 every 6 months just to replace their batteries. Mm. So we realized, whatever the form factor is, even let's say it's a Tesla, you'll probably need to replace the battery 7 or 8 years later, and that's 50% of the EV cost. Hmm. Same problem would exist for all the EVs. It could be 2 years, it could be 3 years. Then this guy had to go back to a parking just to charge or top up his vehicle.
Yeah.
Everyone would need to do that if there is no infrastructure, right? So can you solve for that? And if someone is doing any commercial activity, a cab, a Swiggy driver, a Amazon driver, or the rickshaw itself, they really can't afford that downtime, right? Mm. So those two problems are something that surfaced based on our discussion. And we saw that swapping is one of the solutions that has been experimented a lot in the past across the world. There was Better Place, which raised a lot of money but failed in Israel. There was Gogoro doing well for two-wheelers in Taiwan. I realized maybe we can build something which is swapping, because it takes care of that capex problem, it takes care of the charging problem. It's like a two-minute swap. It's closer to your fuel behavior. You go to point, exchange your battery back on the road. So let's build that, right? And let's just do it for e-rickshaws first, because mm-hmm. that gives you demand. Then you're not a theoretical solution. You have a proof of concept if you're solving it for some customers. Yes. So those were the choices that we made early on, mm-hmm. that we're going to go to swapping and we're going to do it for e-rickshaws right now. Right. Got and it. That is when we started approaching a couple of investors, finding the first backers for yes. our business and started the company.
Very fascinating. Very interesting. I think for a minute, if we can go deeper in that process, right? I'm guessing this would have taken some amount of time to like decide the space, understand the problem, talk to stakeholders, then boil down that, okay, this is going to be our solution, right? Talk to us about the softer aspects, right? Like what were the discussions in that room, right? When you used to go back home, how were you reaching out to these people? Like what was this discovery process? How much time did it take? Maybe if you can go granular there, that really helps.
Sure. So once we zeroed down that we're going to build something for e-rickshaws, mm-hmm. the next task was, let's just go and talk to as many e-rickshaw drivers as possible and right. in different areas, right? Just so that we're not getting a biased view from a cohort of drivers. Mm-hmm. So we traveled to say, we would go from Gurgaon to Noida in the morning, take like 10 to 20 rides in a day, just so that we get to talk to these drivers and figure that out. We would ask them, where do you live? Can you take us there? Where do you charge? Can you take us there? We would then talk to the guy where he was paying to charge his vehicle, how is their business, what are the challenges they see in their business, and so on. Then once we learned that they're using certain kind of batteries, we went back to the battery manufacturers, posing as a buyer and trying to figure out what are the kind of improvements they've seen in that product, what are their expectations on lithium ion coming and replacing these. Then we would go to the rickshaw manufacturers, again posing as a customer. We did a lot of those things. Yeah. But there were also some swapping pilots happening at that time. Okay. So there was a pilot that Ola ran back in 2019 in Gurgaon. So we stumbled upon that while doing all of this. Yeah. And then we spent a lot of time there, because that was clearly not working out well, to be honest. It was kind of demotivating at first, because drivers were not really happy. But then we realized that drivers were not happy because they were being asked or forced to come and swap 4 to 5 times in a day, right? Mm. Because the battery size was probably smaller, the range it was giving was not sufficient. Otherwise, the drivers were happy, except for the fact that they don't want to come 5 times just to Correct. Do that. It is as bad as charging, right?
Correct.
You're going to waste time, kilometers and so on. So, but besides that, the drivers were just queuing up for that service. And Ola then decided to not do this and continue, and they went the OEM way, right? Mm. But we figured that at least there's a proof of concept that swapping can work for e-rickshaws. There are takers for it. Mm. And maybe there are some edge cases that we need to solve for through the product itself. Right. And then I think this was good 2-3 months after registering our company.
Yeah.
We still had a lot of challenges to solve for, because this is a new category, right? And when you're doing a new category, chances of failure are very high, especially in your early days. And you really have to make some bold calls at that point of time. We saw that most of the swapping attempts across the world have been by manufacturers. So whether you'd say Gogoro or the car swapping happening in West right now, say Ample or NIO, they're battery manufacturers. Some large companies in China are two-wheeler manufacturers and battery manufacturers. So is it a manufacturer business is what was, and that's not the skill set Siddharth and I come from.
Correct.
Right? Whereas can we just remove that piece from doing ourselves, at least for now, and then evaluate pros and cons of it? So we then started talking to some of the largest battery manufacturers in India, say Okayas of the world, Livguards of the world, whether they have something or they can build something that we want. Right? We just wanted one or two believers who would build a battery that we are asking them to build.
Correct.
Right? We found like multiple guys willing to take that bet. And we wanted just a couple of batteries to test and pilot. Right?
Yeah.
We found that. And we decided from that day, let's not become a manufacturer. Right?
Mm.
Let's solve for scalability of this business, because it already has a lot of challenges. this is looked upon as an infrastructure business, right?
Yeah.
We don't want to be an infrastructure company, to be honest, as a startup. So can we make it more scalable than anyone else? So can we be asset light, not own these batteries, not own these stations?
Correct.
Right. So those were the next challenges, and then COVID hit us. Right. So the set of challenges just changed overnight.
Yeah.
But I think that was the journey in those initial first 4 or 5 months.
Got it. Got it. Very helpful. I think goes to show that, I mean, as early stage founders, at least you just have to like execute, be in those rabbit holes, discover them and just go deeper. So that's very important to sort of echo. I'd love to come to the solution, but before we get there, just hypothetically, right, or maybe I'm sure you would have made these trade-offs also, that there are, you know, battery management systems, there are ways to maybe innovate on the battery life itself. There are other possible solutions in the same space, the space that you're targeting, questions being around, you know, just charging again and again, and, you know, stationary of the vehicle and how long it can run, stuff like that. How did you discount some of these other approaches, and what was the scenario like, right? If there was a trade-off, what made you stick around swapping as a solution vis-a-vis anything else that you could have done?
So, to be honest, both Siddharth and I are more of people who believe in execution than perfection.
Okay.
That being said, it has both advantages and disadvantages. But in those early days, right, it is very difficult to have answers for everything.
Right.
And we did not have all those answers.
Got
I'll it. Be very candid about it. Right, but what we did believe fundamentally was these customers will not be able to own scooters worth 1 lakh rupees in future very soon, right?
Correct.
If the battery is delinked, decoupled, that's 50,000 rupees. Would they be able to own 50,000 rupees scooters, 40,000 rupees scooters? Maybe yes. Second thing was infra will take a lot of time. Charging solutions to be available everywhere will take a lot of time. Today it looks possible, right? 2019 was not that time. Forget people saying that swapping will win over charging or not. It was the time when people said whether EVs will happen at a large scale or not, right? But we knew that if something is 2 minute swap, it is going to be superior than any charging solution, right? We just have to crack the availability and accessibility kind of challenge, right?
Got
so
it.
We were very bullish on those two propositions, that the solution that we are bringing for this problem is far superior than other possible solutions. Execution wise, what needs to happen to get there is something we will figure it out.
Got it. Fair enough. I think that thesis makes sense, and then we'll figure out the execution. Awesome. That's very cool. Now coming to the solution, right? So again, like I think to clarify, currently, if an EV has to, like, you know, a normal EV has to get, has to run, it can run for a couple of kilometers, after which it has to charge, and that becomes a problem. That charging time is usually 10 to 12 hours, and so that's something. And then they have to replace the batteries, which is another capex, right? So, solve for this, you've had now charging stations, and no, not charging stations, swapping stations,
right,
which is to say that you can swap batteries in under 2 minutes, if I'm not wrong. Can you grill this solution down in the layman terms possible? What happens on the back end, right? Like, do you own the swapping stations? Is it done in partnership? Do you need certain type of batteries that then get charged? How do you ensure the charging, you know, amongst your batteries? Like, what happens on the back end? If you can just maybe, before we go deeper, clarify the solution to us in whole, that'll be very helpful.
Sure. So, from a customer lens, the solution looks like, there are two options. One, you are a potential EV buyer, let's say, and you're looking to buy a three-wheeler or a two-wheeler, right? Because that's the segment we're serving right now.
Yeah.
The option that you have today is go and buy a scooter for as low as, say, 85 or 90,000, which is a low-speed, mid-speed scooter. And I'm assuming you are a commercial driver, a gig worker, Swiggy driver, and so on. That's one option. If you know about Battery Smart and want to be with Battery Smart, the alternative that you have is go and buy the same scooter for maybe 40 or 45,000 and subscribe with Battery Smart.
Okay.
And you start paying per swap. So basically you're paying when you're running, right?
Right.
This is what it looks from the customer lens.
Okay.
Now to make that happen, what we do is we are providing you that first set of battery. So we are basically investing into buying that first set of battery, either ourselves or through our financial partners or asset owners, right?
Okay.
And
yeah.
I'll go deeper into how we do that. So we are doing that as the step one. The second is that wherever you usually drive, right, you should have access to a charged battery. So whenever you are running low on your battery, you should be able to go to a point, exchange your battery with a charged one. So we need to set up a very dense network of stations. Ensure that whenever you need a charged battery, there is a charged battery available. And I cannot ask you to go, say, 20 kilometers to change your battery. It should be on your path. Right. So there's a network planning angle to it, which goes into building out that network. And there's an asset utilization problem, which we need to solve for ourselves. Because I promised you a charged battery. I might end up deploying hundreds of batteries just to serve you because you keep going around the city. But I need to keep reducing that number of batteries. Right. So the three pillars to it is deploying assets, opening stations, and utilizing all your assets. Right.
Perfect.
Now, the first piece, which is more of a infra asset heavy play, when you are taking away 50% cost of everyone's ownership, so there's a large investment required in those assets, right?
Correct.
This was something which was the hardest problem to crack for a startup, early stage, financials yet to be proven, right? And we are just into third year of our operations right now. We started with asset leasing. With platforms which can pool money from retail, buy some assets, lease to us. We went to then NBFCs, started taking loans to buy these batteries. We then went to banks. We're now talking to global investors, financial impact-oriented investors who can buy, help us buy these assets or buy it themselves and lease it to us, right?
Yeah.
So this was one piece of journey. We have currently almost $21 million worth of batteries floating around in the city.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to clarify, these batteries are, I mean, the science behind the batteries, is it special? Like, is it the design is by you? And do they have to be of certain kind to fit in certain OEMs or like EVs themselves, or it can be agnostic?
Sure. So besides this, obviously, there's a large part of the problem is batteries itself, right? And I've not covered that yet. The key to building a large swapping network is that you should have minimum types of batteries, right? Otherwise, your other two problems are then going to multiply.
Correct.
Right? So we have one kind of battery across the network.
Got
so
it.
It is an interoperable solution, whether you bring a two-wheeler or a three-wheeler, whatever brand you are using, it has to be something that works for you, right? So we deployed a battery which is modular. So for example, you bring in two-wheeler, we put in one battery. You bring in a three-wheeler, we'll put two batteries. You'll bring in a cargo vehicle, we'll put four batteries.
Got it.
And it's the same kind, irrespective of who is manufacturing it. So unlike other swapping companies, because we are not manufacturers and we work with multiple folks, but we give them similar specifications to manufacture for us. We don't own really the design. And also we have iterated at least 10 versions of designs in the 3 years. But that's also deliberate. So we think that batteries are evolving technology and product. So we do not want to get married to, say, one chemistry or one kind of cells. We want to evolve with that technology. So whatever is the best available version and that can serve our customers is something we procure and deploy it at any moment.
Right.
We also want to diversify the supply chain risk. So that is why we work with multiple manufacturers. In fact, for most of the people we work with, A, we are the largest buyer. For some, we are the only buyer. We kind of have blocked their production lines for foreseeable future because whatever they can produce, we are happy to absorb.
Yeah.
Right. But during this journey, what we did was we kept going one step deeper on the product itself. So for example, we decided not to be a manufacturer and we stick by it, but we still control and command, say, these are the three kinds of cells we are okay with. So our manufacturer should use that, right?
Yeah.
This is the three kinds of BMS we are okay with.
Then
a step further and said, hey, this is the protocols we want on our BMS. So please introduce these protocols, right? So we keep doing that, controlling the product as much as possible, but the production quality and as well as the design is something that we don't.
Got it, got it. Fair enough. The other side
sure,
now.
Yes. Sure. So from a from the customer lens, we've covered that he needs minimum dead kilometers, minimum wait time, access to a network, right? So we have deployed a large number of assets and we find different pools of capital to deploy that assets on the network.
Understood.
The second leg was establishing those stations, right?
Yeah.
So we set up our first station ourselves. This was the only company-owned, company-operated kind of outlet. This was in West Delhi, Janakpuri, if you're aware of. This is also one of the areas which is very dense e-rickshaw market.
Mm-hmm.
We took like a 300 square foot shop.
Okay.
Just took it before COVID. And then just after COVID, we launched 1st of June 2020 was the first swap we did out of that location. I remember the driver was Vijay Mehto, still with us. But we were a very small team. So it was Siddharth, me, and we had another six people with us.
Yeah.
For entire 1 year, we actually operated out of that station. So that was our office. That is where we met most of the battery manufacturers and called them to. That is where we served the first 40, 50,000 swaps ourselves. Everyone was doing everything. But we deliberately did not go outside West Delhi in that year. And we opened 30 stations just within a 5-7 kilometer radius. Right, because we wanted to test out whether the network has that network effects that everyone talks about, right?
Yeah.
Whether giving that density will really attract more customers or not. What is the propensity to pay for this better value proposition?
Right.
What is the business model that we can pitch to these swap stations? And I'm coming to the second leg because these 30 stations were not owned or operated by us.
Okay.
We reached out to small mop and pop shops.
All
right. Ask them, hey, you have some extra space, right? And we need space as much, say, a fridge, right? Can we put four batteries here and you start charging them, right?
Mm.
And we'll send some customers. And we'll pay you every time a customer comes and swaps.
Swaps,
incurring electricity cost. And you can do it yourself.
Yeah.
We provided them a basic app to kind of authenticate a customer, know if there's something to be collected from the customer, right? And we actually built that during the lockdown. So we had it ready when we did our first swap. So this really worked well with those local mom and pop shops.
Right.
We were still seeing a lot of utilization problems. A lot of stations would not get any customer throughout the day. Some other station will have like queues outside their station, right? Because the network was not really planned where those stations should be.
Correct.
It was more like, can we find people who are willing to bet on this?
Right.
Can we charge them for becoming a partner?
So
we started taking a fee just to become our partner.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and that fee has drastically ramped up in the last 3 years and a wait list as well. But what are the challenges in them operating a station from there, right? Will our customer feel like he's visiting a battery shop, a parking and doing this swapping, or is he comfortable doing that?
Yeah.
Right. So the second leg is the locations themselves. And there what we have is a very scalable model where we can just go onboard a location which is accessible by road and has a power connection. And that is the only eligibility criteria in terms of becoming a partner. And we have access to thousands of such locations through tie-ups, partnerships, and we do a lot of individual mom and pop. But the way we do it is based on where our customer is driving. We just open a station on those dead zones on a heat map, right? So if we know that this is a particular road where 50 people are passing by every day, and there is no station in 2 kilometers. Let's open a station there with the capacity to be able to serve 50 customers.
Yeah.
Right. So the capacity of every station and the location of every station is decided based on the patterns of our existing customers. So every time a new station gets added, that pattern gets changed.
Yeah.
And then new customers get added, the pattern again gets changed. And based on that, we iterate and open every subsequent station and decide whether we have to augment capacity at any of these stations. Right. This ensures that customers will have minimum dead time, minimum wait time, and minimum dead kilometers. Right?
Correct.
Now, the third leg of the problem is you've done all of that. How do you maximize utilization of assets on your network? You bought, say, thousands of batteries, and no one is using them. Right.
Yeah.
The second piece also solves it partially because you've decided the capacity. But then can you nudge your customer to swap at a particular time of the day or at a particular location, because you have a charged battery right there. Right? So as soon as a battery is charged, can it find a customer? Because that's optimum utilization of that.
Charging,
So that is something we're very focused on right now on trying to solve that. And we have a very distributed pattern. So you will imagine that people might queue up in the morning, take a charged battery, if that were to happen, we'll probably need 2x the batteries that the customers have. But we actually operate the entire network now in 15 cities at just 45% additional batteries. So if there are 100 batteries that customers are using, there's just another 45% somewhere getting charged, and that are able to serve all the customers.
Right? Very interesting.
And this happens because there's a flat demand curve, like from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m.
Like
equal demand for those charged batteries, right? So we've been able to create that and optimize the network with that. And this is like at least 3x better than a lot of large companies doing swapping, right?
Got it. This is brilliant. I think this in-depth explanation just shows the kind of execution, planning, intelligence going into making it happen. I'm very fascinated to understand the second and third piece from a data lens, right? Like, what is the kind of, like, I'm sure this is absolute tech, right? So a lot of number crunching, a lot of just advanced data intelligence going into it. How do you make it happen?
So from day one, the first battery that we deployed, we made sure that it has an IoT device inside it.
Right.
So that we get to know real-time GPS location, real-time parameters of battery.
Mm.
For probably a year, we were not really competent enough to utilize that data to the maximum extent.
Yeah.
But then we started building our team, and also we started getting more data from all of these batteries. There are multiple purposes to it. One is to be able to, the driving pattern that I suggested, to be able to plan your network itself. So you need that just for static planning, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of data, what we are getting is like 45,000 battery packs relaying 70 to 100 parameters every few seconds. Right? So it's massive in that sense. And I think there's still a lot more that we can do with that data. But the problem statements that we are going after with that data is A, network planning from early days, then predicting which battery will need maintenance at what point of time, and what would be its lifetime, right? So state of health prediction is something that we are very keen on. We're working with a couple of specialized teams who have actually built AI models on that and trying to integrate that with our data as well.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is safety-related alerts, right?
Yeah.
Both for us and for customer. Right. Mm-hmm. There could be unauthorized charging, right? So if someone attempts to charge this battery with a local charger that they have bought, right? Customer mm-hmm. is not allowed to charge these batteries, and okay. neither can these batteries be charged by a unauthenticated or unapproved charger for that matter. But that is hazardous to customer, right?
Mm-hmm.
The battery could catch fire. People are not very aware on how to use these batteries, right?
Right,
lot of training and education has to go in, but we can also preempt this through data, alert the customer, use that to create more awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something which we call like a control tower, right? So we use that for alerts, to send those alerts, not just to the driver, but also say to the partner stations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to the manufacturers, so that they can improve on the next variation of product in terms of the BMS, in terms of the cell packaging. So that is where data comes in. This is all IoT data, but this is then augmented by a couple of products that we have. So for example, every partner has a mobile app, right?
Mm.
The purpose of that mobile app is to authenticate a customer, know which battery is getting, know which battery is issuing. All of that happens through a QR scan, like within 5 seconds. Manage his ledger, manage his operations, all of that is through mobile app. So a lot of, if you look at swapping companies in the West or in China, you'll see a lot of these fancy automated dispensing machines, right?
Yeah.
Where you can like tap a card on it, you can pay on that, and then a slot will open, which will give you a battery. You can put in another battery and so on, right? We also deployed a couple of few of them, but we realized that the customer really does not care about it. He does not value whether he's getting a battery out of a automatic machine or someone is handing him over. And we already had these partners at the location. What it did was, whatever that machines could do, we just put it on a mobile app. So authentication, payments, knowing inventory logins and logouts, right? All of that is happening through the app.
Mm.
And the charging is happening separately, right? So we debundled that to make it more scalable and more closer to what our customers relate to, right? Now these mobile apps, and then there's a customer app for discovery, payments and so on, and authentication, but they generate another set of data. And then what we do is everyone on our field uses a separate app to do everything that the company needs to do. So this is more towards creating operational efficiencies, right? So if for scaling fast, we constantly need to move from, say, people to process and then to product, right? So for the first year, we were all people. The second year, I think we were all process. And third year was focused on moving everything to product. So that we don't need more people to scale this 10 times or 100 times, right? So I think we are on that third leg and the final leg. And a lot of it has already happened. But there's definitely a lot more we want to do.
Right? Absolutely. Phenomenal. I think a lot of fresh insights. And I'm just like very, very pleased to know all that's happening in the back end. I mean, I was not aware of these things even with my research. So wonderful to know. And I think this is going to be an eye-opener for a lot of people listening. But progressing further, I think we've spoken about the tech and, of course, the solution. But I'm guessing to make this happen just intuitively feels like a very execution-heavy business, right? Because the customers are using a physical battery, swapping it, getting it done at, you know, swapping stations, which are also physical in nature. And then there are these different stakeholders, right? Like you have partnerships with these mom-and-pop stores, with these swapping stations, with maybe an OEM for which you want to get a partnership done. And then these folks who already, you know, the core customer who actually does the swapping. How do you manage all of this? What is the execution muscle you develop over time? How do you look at this, Pulkit?
Sure. So any business which has physical presence, there's definitely a lot of operations involved, right? The way we do it is there's a demand arm, right? Which is responsible to onboard customers.
Okay.
Right. From doing their contracting to KYC to making sure their vehicle is compatible and all of that, right? So that is partially a ground force. But we also do a lot of it through partners. So what we did from day one was the only benefit of doing partner-led swapping model or mom-and-pop store was that you can offload a lot of operations, right? So just like we offloaded charging the batteries, which happens at these stores, similarly, we offloaded a lot of acquisition because it is net beneficial to both of us. It's like a symbiotic relationship, both utilization and customer acquisition. When more customers will give them more business, who will come and swap.
Yeah.
And higher utilization means more revenue for them every day because they have a fixed number of batteries getting charged, right?
Correct.
So we offloaded partially customer acquisition responsibilities also. All of the day-to-day operations, charging, giving out batteries, taking batteries, right? What we still needed was a team to solve for, let's say, inventory of batteries, if a battery needs a service and so on. So we then picked that piece and offloaded it to our manufacturers and said, we'll pay for the warranty. All of that is your responsibility. All logistics, all of servicing.
Servicing is them.
Correct. So that is only the way you can create a very large on-ground business without people, right? Unless you start offloading some pieces, it's very difficult to do that. Yeah. So the charging and day-to-day operations was offloaded to partners, onboarding and acquisition also partially. The servicing logistics part to our battery manufacturers to certain extent. And then we are left with mostly coordination, right? Which happens centrally. So we don't need a lot of people on the ground. Beyond that, we do have teams for example, for inspections, for audits, for training, right? So that is where we want to continue investing upon. Because these are small mom and pop stores. They need to be trained on how to do this. This is a very new business for them. How to follow certain safety guidelines. What are the best practices of dealing with customer. So we try to do a lot of ops heavy stuff on that part. Where also we are now leveraging our mobile apps. So basically bite-sized vernacular videos going out. This is what you need to do. This is where you should be sitting when you are charging batteries. Do you leave it unattended? Things like that, right? So we are leveraging more and more tech to do less and less of people. That being said, there are thousands of assets physically changing hands every day.
Yeah.
So we do like 35,000 swaps right every day. So which means 35,000 batteries are changing hands between two people.
Right.
Right. So there will be operations and there will be a lot of monitoring of that operations. But the lesser we do ourselves, I think the better for us as a company to make it large.
Absolutely. And I think that personifies an asset light model with heavy operations yet offloading it. very interesting. I think this is all like very, very new information and very, very curious to understand more. One specific piece of that must be this offloading to the mom and pop stores and where the swapping actually happens. Can you talk to us about like the quality control measures, like the training that goes into it? How do you decide which stores to approve, not approve, right? This almost becomes like a franchise-like model challenge, right? Because this is almost the forefront and face of your brand. Yeah. Because eventually the customer is going to know battery smart. The mom and pop store is also going to go to battery smart.
Yeah.
How do you do that? How do you select which ones? When you're expanding a city, what is the criteria? Maybe talk to us about that.
Sure. So I think this is one of the hardest problems that the team is working on, right? So we have a Quest team, which we call as quality safety training team, right? So this is like a 12-member team plus some people to help them with audits. So we do three things. And most of this is something that we started in last one and a half year and we were not doing earlier, right? We do a pre-site inspection before we onboard a partner, which is like a comprehensive 60-70 parameters. Post that, they're given certain points that they need to correct for before going live. They do that. It could be civil related, it could be wiring related, and it could be branding related. Post that, they go through a very comprehensive pre-live inspection, and then they have to go through monthly two audits, which is a safety audit and a quality audit, right? And based on that, we even take a call to deboard some of our franchisees who are unwilling to invest in those practices, right? We also disincentivize some of those franchises that unless they correct for certain parameters, we might not send any demand to those locations. We'll not take them live on the app, or we'll reduce the number of customers that, that will be there. Provided to them. So we do all of that. This is one area where we are more on the process piece than the product piece. Eventually, we would want to take this also to a level where we can remotely monitor, maybe leverage CCTV footage to inspect those quality of operations on a real-time basis rather than doing, say, monthly audits and so on. Obviously do a lot of NPS surveys and customer side feedback on how these partners are doing. But more than that, I think it is, we have to balance it out is how I would say it. Right, we want to give those guys more income opportunities. These are small stores. For some of them, the income that they get from battery smart is 2 to 3 times more than their primary business. Right, but at the same time, it is an educational exercise where we want to make them aware that how important it is to perform and operate in a certain manner. Right, both for quality and for safety. Right,
got it.
Which is a hard problem to solve for, given the kind of profile of customers and or partners we are working with, right? So I think that's one challenge we're definitely investing a lot upon, both in time and resources.
How many swapping stations currently?
Close to 500.
500. Wow. And that must be, I don't know, like 5-10 every month growing? Or more?
Much more. So I think just to give you context, right? So as I shared earlier, we were operating 1 year out of Janakpuri, right? This was just 30 stations.
Okay.
Just 100 customers until April 21, right?
Okay.
From there, and this was like, say, 180 to 200 swaps a day. From there, we have reached 35,000 right now from 30 to 500 locations. So we added probably 40 to 50 locations last month. So we do add 3 to 4 locations on some of the weekdays. And the appetite is much more. So we have 15,000 active customers, but we have a 75,000 customer waitlist, right? Similarly, we have 500 stations live and we have a 1,800 station waitlist, right? Already inspected for.
And this is word of mouth completely.
We have not spent a single rupee on digital marketing in the history of company. So this is all referrals, this is all word of mouth. But the constraint to our business is the number of batteries that can get manufactured and can be bought.
Yeah,
so we're probably one of the largest battery buyers right now in India, compared to a lot of two-wheeler or three-wheeler OEMs.
Got it. And what's the lead time to, let's say, from order to manufacture?
60 to 90 days.
Okay.
But we do plan now, at least in having learned our lessons, we do plan now for a year in advance. For example, we have standing orders of close to 500 megawatt hour of batteries to be deployed.
Wow, that's, I mean, those are staggering numbers. Yeah. Brilliant. I think we've covered a bunch of things. I want to come to the scale aspect, but before we get there, can we, like, I mean, to the extent that you can, share the economics of the business, right? So I'm sure, so the swapping station, say, takes something, the customer has to pay something. What does the customer pay? Till what extent does that amount get amortized in comparison to the capex cost if they bought a battery and all of that? And what they pay you, where does it go? If you can just, like, simply put this to us, I think that'll clarify a lot as well.
So for a customer, the comparison is very simple. Let's just compare to lead acid, which they were using earlier, and now they're using, say, they are on battery smart, right? At that point of time, they were spending 20,000 every 6 months. That's 100 rupees a day, roughly amortized. Okay. And they were paying 120 to 150 rupees a day to charge their vehicle, right? So that's around 220 to 250 rupees of daily expense. They were able to run 70 kilometers max and earn 700. So 700 income, 250 expense. That was their economics earlier. Pretty simple, right? We charge the same almost. A driver on an average pays us between 200 and 250 a day.
Okay.
Right? And I'll come to how we charge them, but roughly translates to 200 to 250 rupees of cost to him. Nothing recurring. So it's not like bullet 20,000 and 100 rupees a day. It's more recurring now because it's daily basis, right? Okay. Because he's paying us on every swap. And he is now able to run 115 to 120 kilometers a day. So his income has gone from 700 to 1100. And the cost is same, 200 to 250 and 200 to 250, right?
Got it. So and this
take
is
home
once,
is double.
Home is double and one swap a day, like on an average.
Two swaps. Right. Okay. So every swap translates to roughly 70 kilometers for the customer.
Got it.
So the average is 1.6 to 1.7, which is 115, 120 kilometers that they run, right? So if you do the math, he was taking home 450 earlier and 900 now, right? That is why we have so much inbounds. Now think of this, let's say there are 10 people sharing a accommodation, right? These are mostly migrants running a e-rickshaw in Delhi. Suddenly someone is saving twice the money than everyone else. Obviously everyone else wants to.
It just catches fire, everybody got to know.
And,
okay.
And the amount that we used to charge when we started was just 100 rupees a day, right? And we realized that there's a lot more benefit that the customer is now driving. We staggered our price increases slowly every quarter and so on. We continue to do that right now because there is more ability to pay, more income opportunity that we have generated for them. So there's headroom in terms of revenue. I link this to our unit economics in the third step. The second element to our business, obviously, is the partner, right?
Yeah.
So for a partner, a typical partner would invest an upfront fee with us, which is a one-time sign-up fee. Not really one-time, it's actually makes him eligible to be a partner for 3 years. So it's recurring every 3 years.
Okay.
But a three-year contract fee. And they get paid on every battery swap.
Got it.
What we pay to them, half of that is their electricity cost. And the rest half they pocket.
Okay.
A lot of our partners are now dedicated shops. So basically, someone has taken a 300 square foot shop, battery smart branded, and only doing swapping. It doesn't want to do anything else. They've left their older businesses and so on. These partners typically gross around 2 lakh rupees a month.
Just from swapping?
Just from swapping.
Wow.
And their expenses, electricity, rent, plus manpower is typically around 1 lakh rupees. So they net 1 lakh.
Wow.
Right. And it's a 3-year contract, so they'll end up making 36, 40 lakh rupees. And they paid a small fee to become a partner, right?
Got it.
So that's their economics. Our economics is obviously what we took from the driver. And the direct cost is what we paid to the partner.
Correct.
For every swap, right? Typically, we operate around 60-65% gross margins.
Got it. And
that has to pay for our amortization of assets, right?
Correct.
And that is where all the utilization thing comes into play. The more swaps, that's a fixed cost, right, per month. If we swap more per battery, we can recover our capital faster.
And then the cost of the franchise also.
That's one
revenue,
time
but
revenue.
Okay.
We also charge a upfront fee from every customer. So given the
wait list, become a part of the network.
Just to become our customer, there's a sign-up fee. It's close to 8 to 10,000 rupees.
Got it. Awesome. Very interesting to know that. Great. I think we've covered a bunch of things. As we, go to the concluding aspects, one thing that I was mentioning at the start is also how fast you've grown. And I mean, you put the numbers into perspective as well. But when you're doing something disruptive, I'd love to understand two, three things. When did you realize that this is working, right? Like, this is something that is definitely working. We'll grow this to like 10x, 100x, 500x in the next couple of months. When you did decide this, how did you build processes internally to make it happen? Be it hiring, be it you just saying, you know, 180 members before we started talking, from a 6-member, 8-member team. And in the short span that it's been, right, how do you continuously grow and become ready for growth? And when did you realize it? Would love to cover that entire space.
Sure. So I think this was before the second lockdown, early 21, when we realized that this is really working. Customers are loving it. They're referring more people than we can serve. And there are a lot of input problems to the business to be solved for before we scale this, which is how will we get batteries? What kind of capital do we need for those batteries? So the way actually Siddharth and I do this is we categorize responsibilities as inputs and outputs, right? Okay. So he's the guy who is actually driving all the process and outputs. Mm-hmm. And I have to ensure that whatever he needs as input is there, right? It could be resources, it could be capital or people, right? But and then it's like if we were running a restaurant, right? So probably I'm the manager, he's the chef, right? So he'll give me an ingredient list that he needs, and then we mutually know what we have to achieve for in what time frame, right?
Yeah.
So I think that was the phase where we sat down and decided, let's get all the inputs together, use this second lockdown to kind of build the team, be prepared to just shoot off the ground as soon as the lockdown is lifted. We had probably 20-25 people during that lockdown who would join us immediately when the lockdown would open. We ordered a lot of batteries. In short, we had capital to do that. We did certain sale and lease back and creative financing to free up our cash flows.
Yeah.
And we rapidly started scaling from April, May 21. This is also when we moved to Gurgaon as an office from that older shop that we were operating from. Obviously, that had space for 4 or 5 people. So anyways, 20 yeah. people would not have fit in. And we took a small office in Sector 44 here. But we have not looked back from there. We just constantly then kept solving for both the things. Let's get capital. Let's get more batteries. Let's hire the right people. Let's build processes and move to product wherever we think we know what the process is going to look like forever. Let's just productify it and start scaling that faster, right? And I think it has went well for us in terms of scaling, but I still feel we're still very small, right? So it's probably not the right point in our journey where I would say that we have solved for scale, because it Absolutely. Is easy to scale on a smaller base, right?
Yeah.
The actual growth starts from now when we say we're doing 1 million swaps a month right now, right? We want to do 1 million a day, right? So, so that, and we want to do it in within 2 to 3 years. So that is even harder. I think what happens is when you scale fast, as founders also, we have to reinvent ourselves very frequently, right? And we need to do that again is where we are.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we are at a point where we need to think fresh in terms of scale challenges.
Correct. Solve I think probably the speed and velocity has been like very high right now and it'll continue being. But I think, real scale from like 15 cities to 150 cities someday and like many more will come up. But interesting to know, I think just delegation of responsibilities between the two co-founders was the crucial pointer there. The other bit, right, like that I'd love to just maybe conclude the business side of things and then we'll go and, you know, finish off with a couple of personal questions, is that when it comes to the people side of things, right, just that since things happen in such quick intervals, how do you build context within the organization and don't make it seem for team members that it's just like very short term, right? Like these are the many orders, this is the wait list, let's just complete it, right? Because otherwise you tend to like miss the mission and becomes very short term. How do you manage this short term, long term problem in people and how do you grow the org from a human lens? I think that'll be just interesting to note.
I think this is also the hardest problem for any organization and there's no benchmarks to it, to be honest, other than what the company eventually becomes. But as first principles or fundamentals in terms of the way we want people to do things at Battery Smart has been from the early days, we've never measured people on inputs. We have never kept, say, fixed timings or reportings and targets, mm-hmm. right? It has always been, at least we try to our maximum extent, that every individual working at Battery Smart, even the last man on the field, right, feels as if he's part of the company and he's a part owner, right? So we have tried our best to cultivate that ownership mentality. For example, every employee at Battery Smart has ESOPs, right? And you'll probably find one of the most employee-friendly structure, and we have only had one policy. So it's not something we did now, it's from the day one,
yeah.
right? And this reflects in the kind of retention we have had in people. We have tried again, as I say these points, I know that probably everyone would be doing that. And there's no way to measure these things other than what happens 10 years later and how,
of course.
What kind of organization gets built. But at least we have tried our best to stay meritocratic, which means irrespective of your pedigree, your education level or your age, you get responsibilities if you're driving output and you bring that. For example, our tech lead is, I think, 26 or 27.
Wow.
He's been with us from day one. He's built the entire tech team. We have had zero people leave our tech team in 3 years. Right?
Oh, wow.
Our head of expansion, one of the largest teams, around 35, 40 people. Again, a 27-year guy, but probably the second hire we did. When he met me for the first time, he said, I want to work with Battery Smart without a salary. And I forced him to take some salary. At least you should be able to pay for your expenses to come to office, right?
Yeah.
And he was very bullish about the idea. And he has scaled drastically as well with the organization. He's been able to lead his team and it works for us, right? So we've tried our best to stay meritocratic, and we want that to kind of percolate as the team grows. I know most of those challenges we'll start seeing now.
Yeah.
And we were only 30 odd people last year. The team has also expanded drastically. But I think we have had good people join us.
Yeah.
People who are ownership driven, who've been able to upskill themselves,
mm-hmm.
as we as founders are also trying to do for ourselves. So I think.
Absolutely. Now, congratulations on building that out. And I think the results are a testament of the team, I'm guessing, right? Like, that's a complete transfer.
So it's always the team that drives outputs, right? But
exactly.
As I said, our current results are too small to
measure,
to pass a judgment on what we have been
able to do. I want to be cognizant of that, but just like goes to show that there's some output which is tangibly proving a great value point, and that is a factor of the team. I think one other thing, right, and without making this seem generic, we've talked about the good parts right now, like the things which, you know, of course, seem strategic, tell us what's happened behind the scenes. What are the things that you're not telling us, which is to say that where did things go wrong, what you couldn't figure out, but like faced a really difficult time navigating? What are some of those things?
So I think there are two categories to it. There's some open challenges, how I'd put it, which are still challenges. Mm-hmm. We still don't know how to figure them out.
Okay.
Right. And then there are a lot of challenges that we have been able to partially solve for in the last 3 years. In hindsight, it looks that it's all okay because you have that knowledge now. But when we were solving that, we really did not know whether we would be able to solve them or not. And they were extremely large challenges which could have decided the fate of the company, right? So this second bucket is now very easy to comment on. Mm-hmm. And we don't see them as challenges because, so for example, this is an ops business, but it also has an infra side to it. And then there is a tech side to it. You can build a tech business, and it is already very hard to do that, or an infra business, or an ops business. When you're doing something which is
all three
of them, it poses its own unique challenges, right?
Mm.
Whether it be capital for infra, people and product for ops, and then tech in itself. And very new category, new hardware.
Yeah.
And then our company also has hardware and software. So that's again something.
Yeah.
So I think, and all of these have still open challenges. So for example, when you look at it from an infra lens at our business, there is always a cap to what you can do, right? It's always a function of available capital in terms of the infra side, right?
Yeah.
And for us, we always have to solve for two pools of capital. There's a capital that is going into developing tech and ops, and there's a capital that is going into development of infra.
Yeah.
Right. And when I say infra, primarily say battery deployment for
correct,
us.
Correct.
Then there is solving for the best hardware possible for your customers and software for your economics, because utilization is key to this business. Now, hardware is something that's still a very open challenge, right? Mm. The product quality is still not where we would want it to be as a country itself, right?
Yeah.
Some improvements happening that stays as an open challenge. It's a very fragmented EV market in India today. Hundreds of manufacturers, right?
Mm.
So that is again a very open challenge. How do you bring different stakeholders on one platform? How do you really scale it up by opening it up to every customer who can and want to be on Swapping? So I think that is one of those open challenges, how to put it. And hardware is something that we do not, we are not solving ourselves right now, right? So we're still dependent on a lot of manufacturers to solve for it. Right, their R&D teams, their production capabilities. And when I said that we have offshored or offloaded some responsibilities, that is benefit to scale, but harder to control quality and the efficiency of it, right, at scale. Mm. So those challenges still exist, right?
Yeah.
We have offloaded those operations, but, and as I said, we're building that Quest team and doing correct. Certain audits, but how do you take it to a level where you would have, the way you would have done yourselves, right?
Yeah.
So these are some of the hard problems, and I don't think there's an end state to it.
Correct.
We just have to keep getting better and faster at solving those problems.
Yeah, and then newer, more challenging problems will crop up.
No, but that's the fun part of building something.
Yeah, exactly.
No? So, if it would have been very easy, a lot of people would have been doing it.
Yeah.
And maybe we would not have enjoyed doing it.
Correct. And that's a special part about founders, yeah. I think. They just like love going from one challenge to the other, more challenging problem statement, and tackle it head on and then solve for it, generate value, and then to the next. No, that's spectacular. I think, wow, this has been like a very interesting, insightful, eye-opening conversation. As we go to the last 5-10 minutes, Pulkit, would love to know that, you know, when you talk about this reinventing yourself, right, it seems easier said than done. And I mean, it's very easy for us to have this conversation. We look at you, you know, 3 years having started this, it looks like you have it all figured. What have you tangibly done? There are, you know, things that you don't control, things that organically happen. But what are some tangible things that you've done for your own scalable journey? If you can share that, or things that you have observed become different in you since you became, since you started Battery Smart, would love to gauge that, understand that on a deeper level.
Sure. I think, let's say I wanted to, on a scale of 1 to 100, I wanted to reach 100, or I want to reach 100 today. I think I'm still at maybe 1.5 or 2. So maybe I put a very high benchmark to myself in terms of what I want to be.
You'd say, like, if you are 1.5 right now, what were you?
Probably 1.1 or 1, okay. Maybe. Let's say we start at 1 and I've not traveled that journey too long, and I think that's a constant and I think it depends on every individual on how they look at themselves, but at least I aspire to be a lot better than wherever I am at any point of time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the hardest part, as you said. It's very easy to say, hey, I got so much better at productivity or at managing people or team. But I don't really like to measure that from an output perspective, but more from a perspective of where I want to be or how I want to feel about those capabilities of myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I were to put certain tangibles to it, I think I've gotten more disciplined over these years. I've learned how to be more selfish about my time. It is very important, and I did not know the value of it. I kept hearing that you have to learn to say no to things. But I really acknowledged the value of it after going through that challenge, that Time is really very, very precious now. Yeah. And can't afford to lose it on anything which does not add value to self or to the org, right?
Hmm.
So I think managing my time is something I think I've done. If I were to dissect it into multiple scales, yeah. I think managing my time is something I've done better at. Being more empathetic to people, I think I've done better at. Being more extroverted than I like to be is something I think I've been better at. I think I don't know. I've really not given it a lot of thought. But if I were to pass a subjective judgment on myself without actually going deep into it, is that I'm very far from where I would want to be. But that has been a constant feeling throughout my life, and I would like it to stay that way.
Yeah, it drives you to do more.
Yeah,
awesome. That's I think decently deep and food for thought to think about. And I love how you put it. I mean, you don't have to be satisfied with yourself in any way, and the journey is very continuous. Hope we can, you know, sit for another chat 5 years from now and maybe evaluate that
sure.
Sometime. But for the last bit, I think Pulkit, you know, this is a bit. I don't know, dramatic in nature, but I'll put it the way I have it in my head, which is to say that if you had to go back, you know, 19 November 2019, right, knowing all that you do today, what would you tell yourself so that maybe this 3.5-odd-year journey could have been condensed to lower time or could have been more productive?
If I had the foresight on 19 November 2019 that how this would play out, we would have gone way too aggressive. I think there's so many unknowns at that point of time.
Yeah.
And even more later during COVID, right? So much self-doubt, so much doubt on what will happen about this industry or not.
Mm-hmm.
Even after that, I think even now there, and that is the best part of actually building something which is growing fast and also challenging, is that you have those extreme highs and lows, right?
Yeah.
But if I had that foresight that this is going to be so much fun and this can actually work out,
yeah.
I think we would have been here probably in a year or so rather than 3 years. But
yeah.
That being said, that is the only important fun part for me in this business, the highs and lows. I think both for me and Siddharth. So both of us, and we discuss this a lot, we're probably... We have two less emotions, is how I'd put it. Both of us, both of us are not very social. We're very practical in our approach, and we have like a flat curve in terms of emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say if something drastically good happens with someone, right? We probably would not be the guys who are jumping around, and we would probably feel good for 5 minutes. And same is when something extremely bad happens.
Yeah.
So if you are built that way, you need extreme dopamine or adrenaline to kind of enjoy your life, right? And that is what startups give you. And just digressing from that, I've been a adrenaline junkie all my life. So done skydives, learned skiing and scuba diving and surfing and whatnot.
Yeah.
But now I realize that I enjoyed doing that. And that's like small chunks of adventure sometimes in your life. But building a company is that constant adventure, because it is up to you how much more you want to challenge yourself. Right? And what do you want to build?
Mm-hmm.
And I would do it again. If I had the foresight, I would do it multiple times, and I would do it much sooner.
Brilliant. That's so interesting, the way you put it and the way you've almost defined why entrepreneurs do what they do. Awesome. Thank you so much, Pulkit. This has been an incredible pleasure. I think I have enjoyed so much through the conversation. We've not just covered how you've built the business and what you're going to do more so, but we've also covered the strategic things that go into figuring it out, which is the more important piece. And I hope a lot of the ones listening can apply it in their own context and make something out of it. Thank you so much for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Devraj. I totally enjoyed it.
Awesome. Thank you.